Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host from Washington, D.C., the master of ceremonies, the host with the most, Brian J. Bird Rowan. Next up, from the great state of Texas, the film buff with the right stuff, it's Bill Honey Graham.
Oh no.
Next, from New York, it's Nick Nuclear Newman.
Ooh.
And finally, the dangerous dame of celluloid celebration, from Pittsburgh, PA, it's Amanda Steel City Waltz.
Thanks. I thought you were going to play on my list.
Today on the show, we'll be talking about two films new in theaters this past weekend, each examining, in a rather broad sense, the way young men seek to live up to their fathers. First, a sequel to Rocky that features the aging champ coaching the son of his rival and friend Apollo Creed. From Fruitvale Station director Ryan Coogler, it's Creed. Then, a story about a cowardly dinosaur trying to make his way back home with the help of a feral human child. From Pixar Studios, The Good Dinosaur.
are you going to keep doing this, right?
Yeah, for the rest of the show.
No.
All that and more on today's show. And as always, if you need to reach us, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Follow us on Twitter @FilmStageShow, or comment on the post pages for this podcast at thefilmstage.com/features. Guys, how's it going?
This is amazing.
So how is everyone?
Good.
Woo.
Good. Yeah. Everyone had a good Thanksgiving?
I'm up. Ready to talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
I'm waiting for you to turn the Rocky soundtrack back on to like punk us. Just like,
no, I'm not. I'm not gonna do that.
Thank God.
That was all the shtick I had on me.
Okay, good.
All right. Well, yeah, so that's it. We're not gonna have any discussion today, though I do want to give a shout out to Mad Max Fury Road. That won the best feature from the National Board of Review.
That's pretty something.
That is pretty something, awesome. Something. The Gotham Awards happened last night, but who gives a shit, right?
Also mentioned to Ridley Scott for winning Best Director for The Martian. What?
Sure.
Yeah, that was a very odd choice.
Yeah.
Very strange. But anyway, so much to talk about today, so let's hop right into it. Ladies and gentlemen, our first review will be Creed, newest film from Fruitvale Station director Ryan Coogler. This stars Michael B. Jordan, Sylvester Stallone, and Tessa Thompson. Here is the trailer.
You're not built for this. These boys coming here, they gotta fight for life. People die in the ring. Your daddy died in the ring. I don't know him. Ain't got nothing to do with me. I've been fighting my whole life. It's not a choice for me.
So this is a spin-off sequel of kinds to Rocky and all other attendant Rocky films, I guess. So, just a real quick show of hands, who here has seen other Rocky films? I'm assuming we've all at least seen Rocky the First.
Yep. I've seen quite a few. My mom's a huge fan, so I was forced to watch quite a few.
I've seen all of them.
Oh, you've seen all of them?
I have, yeah.
All right.
Even the fifth one?
I've seen the fifth one multiple times, actually.
Wow.
Very derided.
So have I.
It's quite bad.
I've only seen the first. all the way through.
Oh, the first one's so wonderful.
I've seen bits and pieces of the others, but I was planning on actually doing, like, I even had like a Facebook post, like getting people's opinions about like which ones I should watch and if I should watch all of them. And I took all that information and basically did nothing with it. It was great.
I've seen the first and Rocky Balboa, and I know I've seen parts of the fourth one. So.
Oh, the fourth one is so good. The fourth one is sort of indicative of a trajectory in the Rocky movies that is very similar to Fast and Furious, where he goes from being human to being superhuman.
So it's the Fast Five of the Rocky films.
It is basically he and Dolph Lundgren go for a million rounds. I don't even remember how many rounds they go. It is unreal. Like, they should
What about like the ring girls? Like, did they just keep coming out with numbers? Just like writing numbers?
They just kept coming out. I can't remember how many rounds it was. It was an obscene amount of rounds. That's all I remember. And my mom and I were just watching it.
There wasn't like a decision. It was like one of them had to be knocked out.
Yeah, one of them. Well, it was the Cold War.
So death?
You
know,
somebody had to win.
All right. Well, Nick Newman is with us for a limited amount of time, and we do want to get his opinion on the film. So, Nick, we will give you the honor of going first.
Oh, wow.
Drawing first blood, if you will.
Okay. Throwing the first punch.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's another Stallone reference.
It is.
But anyhow.
Wrong Stallone.
Yeah, so this was kind of a surprise in the sense that I think I sort of had a good feeling about it going in, if only because the idea of it is different enough where it doesn't necessarily feel like a cash grab. And also, I think the fact that based on a lot of things he said in the past several years, Sylvester Stallone hasn't had much desire to revisit the series because it ended on, to my mind, a pretty good note with Rocky Balboa, which I think is sort of an undervalued movie, even though it's well-received. It has a lot of very good things in it. And
Break in real quick, wasn't this film brought to Stallone?
It was, yeah. But okay. What I'm saying is the fact that he went with it and you know, was willing to ride with it. I didn't see Fruitvale Station, but a lot of people who I know and trust said that it was quite poor. And so I kind of...
Really?
Yeah. And so I kind of thought, well, you know, this sounds different. So if Ryan Coogler's, you know, breakthrough film was not a hit, then perhaps his next one will match up more. And then the reception to it has been really overwhelmingly positive in a way that I, even having an idea that it could turn out well, I couldn't have anticipated. And so going into it, I was kind of trying to get a feel for it initially. And during the first, maybe act or so, I thought it was a bit clunky. It seemed like there wasn't really anything natural in the movie. It was moving at such a quick clip where sort of every line of dialogue had to serve a function. The dialogue was very functional, and every line is just kind of, you know, a reference to the fact that his father used to be a boxer, that Rocky knew his father, that he wants to be a boxer. I mean, those are kind of like the three templates that the dialogue fits into for the first act. And, you know, it's the movie, I think the movie kind of needs to slow down a bit. For instance, when he first gets to Rocky's house and he decides to live there, and he looks at a photo of Rocky's son, and Sylvester Stallone just lets out this whole thing. Yeah, he lives in Vancouver now with his girlfriend. You know, it wasn't easy being Rocky Balboa's son, but, you know, I miss him and I hope he's happy, and, you know, it's good to hear from him again. Okay, I'm just going to go over here. And it's like, okay, all right, you're unloading a lot of information in one moment. You know, the movie didn't really have a moment to breathe, is the thing. But once it becomes more about a single objective, which is training for a fight, when it can be, I think, a bit more, not necessarily single-minded, but when it has more of a single objective, and then it can use everything around it to work with, then it, I think it works fairly well. I mean, for one thing, it seems like there's this, you know, whole relationship angle with, what was the girl's name?
Bianca.
The character? Bianca. Yeah. Played by Tessa Thompson, who I don't know if I've ever seen in anything before, but who I thought was quite good. And, you know, there is kind of, the movie lets the scenes actually play out a bit, and it lets them talk about things that don't relate to him specifically, this character. The fact that she has this hearing loss problem I found kind of interesting because it's not really a metaphor for anything. It's not really meant to reflect. I don't think it's really meant to reflect anything necessarily, except the idea that, you know, everybody has their struggles, which is something that this movie gets into, but it doesn't try to bake that too much into the fabric of the movie. It's willing to just kind of let things play out after a while. And there, you know, it became nice to, it was one of the surprises of this movie is that I didn't feel an absence of Rocky Balboa, who is, you know, let's be honest, he's the big draw here for a lot of people, is that they get to see him in at least one last movie, and then there's sort of this novelty because now he's in the Mickey position, essentially. But I liked the character of Adonis Creed. Don Johnson, funny enough, is his name,
yeah.
Which I feel like not enough people point out. You know, I think that the way that he's conceptualized, I think the way that Michael B. Jordan plays him, is all very kind of affable. There's something very sort of relatable about him in that the way he's written, he feels like an actual person and not this superstar athlete, even though he's depicted as being very good at what he does. So the movie is kind of operating on a few levels at once. And then I like how at the end, I think the movie kind of seeds itself to more immediate, just kind of this, you know, pure emotion, essentially, of the fight and the immediacy of it, where suddenly you can think about all the struggles he's gone through, but it also comes down to landing the punch, dodging the punch, taking the punch, as a good boxing movie in its climax should. And it was funny, too, because this movie, you know, does a pretty good job of playing its crowd, because I saw it in a theater, obviously.
And
the theater wasn't even that crowded, because I saw it a Saturday at 3:30. But still, you know, when there are some pretty nasty punches landed on Creed, and when he lands nasty punches on his opponent, you know, the audience was really with it. They were cheering, they were, you know, recoiling. And yeah, I mean, it's a movie that I think does very well to please its audience while kind of serving its own objectives. So it's a film that works, yeah, fairly well. I've seen some people say this is one of the best films of the year, you know, putting on their top 10 list. I wouldn't go that far, but, you know, whatever. It doesn't need to fulfill that either. It can just be good on its own, and I think it is. So overall, yeah, I'm pretty positive on Creed.
All right. Amanda Waltz, what about yourself?
I actually wasn't really looking forward to watching this movie. My husband really wanted to see it. I don't know if I would have gone to watch it if not for this podcast and him, honestly. That being said, I do, like I said before, I do enjoy the Rocky movies.
So why wasn't this on your list?
I don't know. I think it just, it's kind of like what Nick said, and it almost seemed like a bit of a cash grab. I was a little skeptical about it. But I love the first Rocky, and this movie captures just what a visceral and emotional experience that movie was. I remember my mom telling me when she went to see Rocky in the theater, she said people stood up and actually cheered during the fight scenes. Like, that's incredible to me. Also, that sounds like a horrible nightmare because I hate when people do anything in the theater, but
you're breathing.
Yell at people for blinking.
Anything loud,
too
loud. Chewing. Oh my god, it's gonna send me over the edge. But and yeah, in my theater too, there was actually a woman sitting two rows behind me who, during one of the climactic fights, I don't even think it was a fight scene. I think it was during a really intense dialogue between Don and Rocky, she actually gasped very loudly twice. So, I mean, and I haven't experienced that in a while. But yeah, I really like this movie. And it made me realize just what it is about cinema's sort of fascination with boxing and why boxing is so, like, really lends itself to film. Because there is that one scene that is, I don't know if it's supposed to look like one long take.
The first big fight.
The first big fight. It looks amazing. The camera,
it looks fantastic.
It looks fantastic. The camera is so nimble. It's just sticking with the two characters as they're fighting. Coogler, I think, really has a grasp on what this film is supposed to be about and like what he wants out of it. I think it's fair to note that the cinematographer on this project, Maurice Alberti, who is a very prolific cinematographer.
Over 85 credits to her name or something like that.
She's incredible, yeah. I mean, she's worked on documentaries, narrative films. She did The Wrestler, which makes sense mm-hmm. in terms of this film. Yeah. Also, side note, she did The Visit.
Oh.
Which is, she also did WikiLeaks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so she's, I mean, really just, they did an incredible job. And there's just so many... I mean, it sounds kind of cheesy to say, but like Sylvester Stallone is so great as Rocky. Like, it's like a comfortable old pair of shoes. He knows this character. He obviously loves this character, which I don't think you never get that sense with the other characters he's played throughout his career. He really loves this character. And like, I think one of the things like, just going back to the original Rocky film, the original Rocky film is hilarious. And Sylvester Stallone is hilarious in that as that character. He's so naturally funny. And he brings that to this movie. He's just like this really, I don't know. He's just such a like, it's just such a great character. I don't know. And it feels so like cheesy to say that, but he is just such a like charming, lovable, old, cuddly man. Version of Rocky now where it's just like it's just I don't know, there's, and of course there are things that happen in this movie where you're just like, no, Rocky. It's just so like makes me feel so like ridiculous as a 33-year-old woman to like get upset about it, but yeah. And I really enjoyed I thought Michael B. Jordan did a great job. I thought Tessa Thompson, who is having quite a good year. She was in Dear White People. She was in Selma.
She's going to be in Westworld as well.
Yes, I'm so excited for that. But she's great. I mean, she's a really great actress. And I actually did like, going back to what Nick said, the whole, I think the...
Hearing loss?
The hearing loss, I think, really plays into the idea that you have a limited amount of time to accomplish what you want to accomplish, because she has a limited amount of time to become a singer, and he has a limited amount of time to become a accomplished boxer. So I kind of liked that aspect of it, where it wasn't just like this, oh, we just need to make this female character a little more interesting. Like, it actually did like play into some of the themes of the film. And I loved their scenes together. I thought that it was very natural. It was very intimate. They were very playful. You know, I just liked the way their relationship played out. And just the pure spectacle. It would go from these very intimate, sweet scenes of them together. And then you'd see, I mean, Michael B. Jordan looks so good in this movie. And he's just like bringing this like physical and emotional power to the role. I mean, he's just really embodying it. And the pure spectacle of the boxing scenes, I mean, it is just really great. And there's like some hints of like Raging Bull, and it doesn't really feel derivative necessarily, but there's just like, you know, you can tell, I feel like Coogler probably did his homework for this film, and it really pays off. And yeah, I was really surprised. I was really pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed this film and how emotionally invested I got. And yeah, I don't, like Nick said, I don't think it will make my top 10 list necessarily. But I think just as like a very like gratifying experience, it's just a really like pleasant, wonderful film.
All right. Bill Graham.
Yeah. I gotta go with everybody else's kind of viewpoints. It is interesting because one thing that I noticed about this film in particular was that it was getting a ton of hype. And like Nick was saying, I mean, it was just to the point where you couldn't avoid hearing good things about this film, which is, you know, that's fine. That's great. Especially with a film like this that a lot of people, I think, kind of looked over it I mean, you know, it is Creed. It is the seventh in this series of films. It's, you know, kind of like, oh man, another one of these, you know, and it is interesting, the kind of genesis of the film, that it was actually brought to Stallone and stuff like that. So I really, you know, wanted to give it kind of a longer look than what I normally would for a film, you know, a seventh film in a franchise. But I gotta say, I really quite enjoyed it. The audience was into it. They loved it. And I gotta say, I've seen quite a few boxing films over the years, and even like this year. I mean, what was the film with Jake Gyllenhaal?
Southpaw.
Yeah, I saw Southpaw as well. And, you know, it gets to a certain point where you think you've seen just about everything you can see with a certain, you know, genre of film, especially like, you know, the sports boxing movie and stuff like that. But the first fight in this film really, really opens up the doors for something special, I think. And it's a shame that it goes away from that camera style. Obviously, they have a bigger story to tell in the final big climactic fight. And, you know, but they completely shuck off the kind of first person perspective, and to be honest, I didn't even notice that it was a long take. All I noticed was that it was in the ring with the fighters and constantly either giving us the perspective over the shoulder or even like a first person point of view of the fight itself, and it was very visceral. And I remember watching it and just thinking that it had sold me completely on the film. Whatever it had done from that point on, or even prior, I was completely sold on the film at that point. So definitely Maurice Alberti, you know, should get a hell of a thumbs up for that. And I gotta say, I also really enjoyed Tessa Thompson in that role. You know, I think Amanda's smart in the way that she's kind of pointing out that, yeah, it does kind of reflect an athlete's kind of life, in that you have a very limited window to make as much money, to make as much impact as you possibly can. And then, you know, your body's just gonna give up. It's not going to be able to keep going the way that you would want to and compete with other people around your, you know, the 20s and 30s. Like you would. So it is an interesting parallel in that way. I also got to say that the Coogler does some interesting things, like the way that he introduces each fighter. He's got their scorecards. He's got all of these things that you're kind of like, all right, it feels almost video game-esque.
I was going to say, it's a lot like how people in that video game Badlands are introduced. Uh-huh.
It's got like a little side screen, and it's like telling you all their stats and stuff like that. And I thought that was pretty neat. That was a nice touch. What else did I want to say? Really, I think I love Stallone in this film. He gets a lot of bad rap because of, you know, he is what he is. But it's funny because, As much as he gets a bad rap, I think this is one of the few films where he's really able to embrace it and just own that kind of character. And again, you know, like we said at the beginning of this podcast, I haven't seen the rest of the Rocky films. I've only seen Rocky and then this one. So I'm really not as familiar with his stable of work in this film franchise. But I got to say, I think he absolutely nails it. And I love his character story, without going into too much detail. I think it's relevant even today. It's got a potent message. And there's a sequence in the middle of it, of this film, where I don't even know what to call him. Baby Creed? We'll call him Baby Creed.
Don't call him Baby Creed.
Anyways, he's running down the street towards Rocky's place, and he's got all these guys on their motorcycles or dirt bikes and four wheelers, and I just thought that was another one of those kind of standout sequences, and it ends in a weird way that I was like, this should have ended like a minute ago, but I really enjoyed that sequence as well. And yeah, I don't know, I feel like I'm rambling, but the film is just a really, really rousing success, I think, as far as, you know, the sports movies and things like that. Top 10, we'll see, but yeah, I dug it.
It's actually crazy. I was going to mention the dirt bike gang, because mm-hmm. they're actually a real thing, and they
were
in Baltimore. I don't know about Philly, but because this takes place in Philly, but they were the subject of a documentary called
12 O'Clock Boys.
Yeah.
I was going to bring that up. I'm glad and angry that you stole that from me.
It's funny because so I was watching it in at the Alamo, and they always do these kind of intricate pre-show kind of clips that they put together that usually have some kind of relevance to the films and stuff like that. And they had one where these guys are using little GoPro cameras on like selfie sticks and like recording themselves, like driving all up and down like this neighborhood street, popping wheelies and doing all this stuff. And I remember watching it, you know, and obviously this is before the film starts. So I'm watching it and I'm like, I don't have a clue what's going on, but this is crazy. So
it's wholly illegal. I mean, strange too. As somebody who's grown up in the country, to see a bunch of kids in like inner city Philadelphia on four wheelers and dirt bikes, it's really crazy. I don't know, because
doing crazy wheelies,
and it's that sequence with him running is, and I knew it was coming because I saw a glimpse of it in the trailer, and when it started,
yeah,
I was getting a little emotional, you guys.
I was nervous all throughout that scene, because that's the type of scene that could really fall flat on its face.
Oh yeah,
and it doesn't. I was pretty happy about that.
Well, he knows. I think one of the biggest one of the most surprising aspects of this film too is that they know when to use slow motion to a really great advantage, which is something that a lot of filmmakers tend to not know how to use slow motion properly or misuse it. But
well, there's not that many that use it outside of Zack Snyder.
And that's
Snyder.
Why.
I was about to say, we want to talk about Zack Snyder right now.
It can look cheesy.
It can
look real bad. Yeah. But I think in this film, it just enhances so many montages. Dude, I could not get enough montages in this movie.
Oh, the montages are really good in this.
Dude.
One thing I want to mention real quick is the introduction of the final fight sequence, the final fighter.
Oh my god,
that was epic.
So fantastic.
Are we talking about the tracking shot or the single take, since it was
when he's coming out and he's just like, whoa, okay,
I was like, what is gonna happen?
Well, Nick, I know that we were around the time where you said you might have to dip off. Was there anything you wanted to say in response to anything that you've heard so far?
Yeah, I got maybe 15 more minutes. So, two things. One is that during the sort of initial section when I wasn't sure if I was with it or not, I did groan although I guess I also found it funny when he's watching some sort of, I think it's an HBO program
on his iPad,
and it shows clips of Apollo Creed and Rocky both training separately, but the clips look as if it's a camera filming them, but it's not. It's just clips from the movies when they were training during the montages, and I found that kind of funny, just because it sort of suggests there was a camera there while Rocky was, you know, training with Mickey and Apollo Creed was training. Something about that I just found kind of amusing. Anyway, that's one thing. Secondly, another weird detail is that I wonder if Ryan Coogler has never A, been to England, or B, met a British person, because I think that the guy, the trainer, is maybe a better Bond villain than Christoph Waltz, because he's in this mansion, like this countryside mansion, and he's sitting. Was he sitting next to a raging fire, or does my memory just have that?
I think there was a hearth.
There was definitely a fireplace there, but I don't.
Because he was raging. Yeah.
He's sitting there and he's talking in his, you know, very thick British accent. If that's just how the actor talks, you know, I am 100%.
His name is Graham McTavish.
Okay, so he's not from the United States, probably. Or if he is.
Scottish, it seems.
Scottish, okay.
Do you think he's Scottish, you guys?
Graham McTavish is a Scottish television, film, and voice actor. McTavish also had many supporting roles in British dramas and films, such as Casualty, Jekyll, The Bill, Taggart, and Sisterhood. I could go on.
Are they only allowed to title their television shows with one word?
He played Dwalin the Dwarf in the Hobbit trilogy. And it seems like
he's from the Isles.
It seems like his appearance has not changed between them. But anyway, I just found it kind of funny how it's these shot reverse shots of the sides of their heads as they're talking, and it's just so nefarious. And you know, there's this dastardly plan going on to go out on top.
He's kind of a dastardly dude, though.
He's a dastardly dude, but what I like is that his fighter, Pretty Ricky Conlan, is not.
Oh, no, I was talking about Pretty Ricky.
Oh, really? I really liked what they did with Pretty Ricky.
Because he's going to jail. It's his last fight before he goes to prison.
Yeah, but the thing is, he's not looking just for like a quick payday. Like he wants to build his legacy. They say the word legacy a lot in this film.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he's not an inherently bad person. I mean, obviously, they make a big deal about how boxers tend to come from poverty, from the street. Uh-huh. And, you know, that's where he comes from. So he got popped for the same
thing. He's from the docks. His father worked in the docks.
Right. He's from Liverpool.
So I find it funny how this is supposed to be sort of a stripped-down, back-to-basics Rocky movie, but it does kind of indulge in the Rocky villain.
Oh, it
thing,
does.
The Clubber Lang, Ivan Drago sort of thing, which was interesting. I'm not sure.
But the
it feels a little out of place to me, but I also did laugh. So,
I don't know. I didn't have a problem with it because he's going to prison, and he says in the documentary thing that Donnie watches, you know, I'm going to be going to prison for 7 years during what should be the prime of my career. So this final fight has to be something that I can build my legacy on. That's right. Going to be it. And well, so he's pissed off because some no-name guy who just happens to be the illegitimate son of Apollo Creed shows up, and this is what he's stuck with.
But they thought he was going to be like a fall guy because he's...
Pretty Ricky did not want him to be a fall guy.
Well, obviously.
He says, this isn't, you know, what I thought my legacy would be, that I would just be knocking out Apollo Creed's illegitimate son.
Well,
he's upset, and he wants exactly what Creed wants. He wants to do something real and earnest and honest, shitty fucking manager is like, yeah, whatever, we need money.
Right. Well, for me, it's not so much Pretty Ricky Conlan as is just the trainer, who kind of reminds me of, in Rocky IV, the, you know, the guy who's always overseeing Ivan Drago, who's wearing the full diplomat suit and the cap.
You mean Brigitte Nielsen?
Oh, that's mean.
No, I'm joking. She's a very beautiful woman.
Can we all kind of laugh at some of the moments in this film that have a... I'm thinking specifically when Adonis first mentions to Rocky that he wants to take this big fight at the climactic moment, and he yells to nobody in particular, even though there are people working in the kitchen in the back, he yells, "I'm gonna fight," and he yells it really loud, and he kind of like looks around, and the camera's like, you know, obviously right next to him, and you're just like, who are you? Like, what is this movie again? Because there's several moments in this film that have those kind of moments where you're just like, that was an interesting decision.
Well,
I should probably say that I like this film. I don't think I actually have given my opinion yet.
You didn't.
No, I like this film a lot. It's according to Letterboxd, it is currently my number 13 film of the year. Probably won't make the top 10. I don't see it growing more in retrospect than how I initially felt about it. But it's great, and I agree with literally everything you all have said to the positive. The cinematography is beautiful, and I think it could be up for an award. I wouldn't have a problem with that.
I will say I did love Meek Mill's song.
Who is that?
Meek Mill?
I don't know.
He's a rapper?
Sure.
Yeah.
You don't know Meek Mill?
No.
We're not from Philadelphia.
Neither am I.
Pittsburgh.
Yes.
They're the same place.
The natural enemy of Philadelphia.
Pittsburgh. I thought that was class. Oh!
Anyway. Oh, actually, Nick, I was going to say, I kind of agree with you on the clunkiness of the first act. My husband actually used that exact same word to describe it when we were driving home. I think it's very, like, melodramatic, because Felicia Rashad plays Creed's widow, and she goes to claim him from a...
Is that little kid a good actor or really bad?
I thought he was great.
No, it's hard to criticize kid actors.
I know.
It is. But, like, yeah, that whole thing where he has his fist clench and then he loosens it, I was like, oh, come on, guys.
Yeah, that was kind of a, you know, sort of a red flag for me. I mean, the thing is, something about the environment, maybe they shot it in an actual prison, I don't know, but it sort of looked like a warehouse that had been rented for the day. Something about it didn't really feel lived in or authentic to me. I think because you're just seeing it so quickly. Because you're seeing this fight and then you're seeing him in the room. There's not really a sense of place to it the way there's a sense of place in the other environments.
It's weird
Philly.
Lived in
if we're
or
eating
authentic.
Cheesesteaks
it's
now.
We're talking about the boys' home that he's in, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
The youth
it's like a juvenile
home.
Detention facility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you want that to feel lived in?
Something about it. What I'm saying is that it's too quick, just the way we move through it. I guess I couldn't really get a sense of. It was just kind of defined by one thing, which is kind of that aggression and that fight that's going on. And so it just wasn't. It felt kind of perfunctory. Again, like what I said about a lot of the first act is that it felt very sort of functional to me, is that everything was kind of about three things. You know, Rocky knew his dad. He wants to be a boxer, and people don't want him to be a boxer, and it's just kind of like, all right, let's move on. So, you know, the thing is, you know, because I like the rest of the movie a fair amount, in retrospect, I'm kind of like, all right, I mean, yeah, I'm willing to forgive kind of a clunky setup if it leads into something good. And so
right,
in this instance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, I felt the same way. I thought the ending was also a bit, I don't know.
What, the last scene?
We can get into that.
The last scene's nice.
You like the last scene,
Nick?
I do.
Nick has a beating heart every now and then.
I know. I guess it was just, I don't know. Well, we'll talk about
it. Yeah, you were hoping that Nick would be the only person who'd agree with you.
I'm a heartless bastard.
Yeah. I guess me saying I agree with all of you is enough.
I
keep trying and you keep hijacking it from me.
Oh, go ahead.
No, it's cool. I don't have shit to say. No, all right, I'll bring this up. There's this one scene that illustrates a lot of what I like about this film, and it's when Adonis and Bianca are together in her apartment, and he's like doing her hair as they're talking.
I love that scene.
Would you like to go on and talk about why you love it? No. So yeah, there's a tenderness and a sweetness and a realness to the characters there that I feel gives them the kind of internal life that a lot of movies like this sort of gloss over, so that you can see them as real people with real desires and see just it's a kind of relationship that you don't get a lot. These two people who both have lives outside of each other and have to negotiate that to be together. And it's this moment of real beautiful companionship and intimacy.
And that's what you want from like a, and I feel bad for even calling it, but I mean, it is a side storyline, right? And that's what you want from a side storyline, is something that you actually wouldn't mind continuing to follow for a little while.
Right.
Yeah. 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 No, I did. Sorry, I couldn't contain myself, Brian.
Whatever. Wait till we get to the good dinosaur and you don't have shit to say anymore.
I don't. I will probably say something, though. Also, I had a couple logic questions with this movie.
Does that pertain to spoilers? So should we jump into that?
No, just a couple quick ones. Who's running the restaurant when Rocky is training Creed?
I would assume he has a manager.
Also, why does he still live by the train tracks?
Because he fucking wants to. I mean, that's the house.
He's a simple man. He has simple desires.
He still has the turtles. Like, he never had a lot of ambition in the first movie.
But didn't he have, like, a huge mansion? I think maybe in the third one. And he bought a little butler robot.
Yeah, have you seen Rocky V is the question. Because in Rocky V, it's explained that while he was defeating communism, Paulie signed over the rights of his finances to the lawyer who spent the money. And it's so stupid because the thing is, he just united the world's two warring superpowers in a boxing match. If he came back, he could do 2, maybe 3 commercials and get all of his money back. Right. But instead the movie says, well, gotta move back to the, you know, to the shitty house, back to the bad neighborhood, kids. And it's like,
but I think that there's a part of him that wants to be there. I mean, you know, he's going through, he's showing the rooms, and you know, he's got a crappy wooden folding chair stuck in a tree next to the graves of his friends.
No. Here it makes sense. In Rocky V, though, it makes no sense whatsoever.
Oh, Rocky V is a terrible movie. Oh, speaking of which, you were talking about that very dismissive scene with his son, Nick, which it's kind of sad, actually, because his son, who was in Rocky V, Sage Stallone, died in real life.
Yeah.
And part of me wondered if when he picks up that picture and says, oh, is that your son? He obviously tells this very dismissive story. If later on in the movie, he was going to tell him, or Creed was going to find out that his son actually died, and that's why he's, you know, he's so weird about it.
No, I think he's estranged.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm glad they
Milo
didn't do that.
Because I think Malenglia in the last one.
Well, right, I'm just saying,
I don't know
how they
to
didn't
say
do that, because I felt it would have been a little exploitative, considering that his son really did die.
Yeah, how many, like, and you know, his wife and his friend and his trainer are all dead. So, I mean, like, how many more dead people does he need?
No,
that does become a point that he talks about.
Paulie dies, yeah. I mean,
Paulie should
have died a long time ago.
No, he has a great line in Rocky Balboa, where he comes to the restaurant and Rocky is like, here, I'll have the cooks make you something special. And he says, there's nothing special about Italian food made by Mexicans.
Ooh.
I laughed at that line.
I don't remember that line.
You don't remember that?
No. Oh, jeez. All right, well.
One thing I wanted to mention that I thought, I think it was Amanda that first mentioned it. Just the filmic quality of what a boxing fight is, or boxing match is. And I thought this film specifically comes at a weird point in boxing's history where it is playing a very far second fiddle to MMA and UFC and everything like that. And you're right. I think part of it is a large generation kind of fell in love with the idea of boxing and its kind of filmic qualities, one-on-one, just fisticuffs and things like that. And I think it's really been kind of trumped lately by MMA, and I don't know if it's necessarily just the money has followed MMA, or if it's just, and you know, I don't know about y'all, but I actually
it's these damn millennials. You know, everything needs to be faster and more violent. I mean,
it also sucks that the poster boy for boxing right now is Pretty Boy Floyd, who's, I mean, kind of a bag of shit. So
yes, yeah.
Wait, is his name really Pretty Boy Floyd Mayweather?
Yeah, you didn't know that?
What do you mean,
no.
Really?
Isn't it Pretty Boy Floyd? Am I wrong?
That's a bank robber.
No,
I'm pretty sure his moniker is Pretty Boy Floyd.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Precedent. But Pretty Boy Floyd was gunned down and killed. It's not really a good precedent.
Yeah, Pretty Boy Floyd Mayweather.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's also Moneymaker Mayweather.
I just didn't realize that it was Pretty Boy, and it's weird. Yeah. Because like Nick said, Floyd was gunned down.
Nicknames Pretty Boy Money. Yeah. Okay. Glad we cleared this up, guys.
Yeah. TBE, the best ever.
Do you want to get into spoilers before we get to...
We've been talking about this for almost a quarter of an hour already. Or three quarters of an hour, I should say. But yeah, let's get into spoilers. So spoilers for Rocky. Not Rocky. Spoilers for Creed. So Rocky gets cancer. And what? This... I will speak, Amanda. So... God damn it, I will speak now if never again. So there's a really heartbreaking scene when he finds out and the doctor starts telling him his options. And he, with like a little choke, he like takes off his hat and he shakes his head and he's like, no, you know, my wife did that and it didn't happen. I'm not going to do that. And it was rough. It was rough to watch that. I was choked up. Thought I was going to cry. This movie didn't make me cry. I think that might hold it back, because a good movie can break through that stoic Irish barrier of mine. And this came close a number of times.
I was actually surprised that I didn't cry in this film. It had a lot of things going for it, and that moment in particular is definitely one of those moments that's just like, oh yeah, here's the tear scene. And some reason, I don't know what it was. I don't know. I think it was just the inevitability that I had already kind of known that there was going to be a planned kind of like trilogy out of spun off of this film, that I was like, oh, we're not going to see this yet. So
no,
but
just be still fighting cancer in the next film.
But I did think the way that Adonis kind of is like, you know, either I can be really mad at you and I can push you away, or I can give you a reason to stick with me. And I think it's a little ham-fisted, but it works in the narrative of the film, in that, you know, Rocky obviously still wants to train Adonis even while going through this cancer. And Adonis is like, no, I'm not going to let you train me and have this kind of hoorah moment if you don't, you know, fight cancer inside of me. And I was like, okay, that works.
Well, it really recalls, I don't know if you guys remember the scene in the first Rocky when Mickey goes to Rocky's apartment to try to convince him to let him train him. And Rocky shuts a door in his face and he's just on the other side of the door withering, talking about how he's done and how he's getting old and this is his last chance. That is heartbreaking. Just seeing Burgess Meredith just, oh, it's so just crumbling, like emotionally crumbling. It is.
Well, it's like when in this film, Stallone says, you know, we're not family, that was just in our heads. And then as soon as the guy, you know, Creed runs away, he's like, you know, breaking down and sits down. He's like, why on earth did I even say that? Like, he knows it's not true. And it was, you know, but he's dying and he feels left behind by everything else, and he doesn't want to feel as though he's going to be leaving behind someone else. So I will say the other part that nearly got me.
Nick, does Nick want to say anything? He's probably got to leave here soon.
It's definitely a sort of a, you know, an echo of Mickey's death in Rocky III. And I do wonder, I mean, because there will undoubtedly be a sequel to this movie, and I do wonder what exactly they'll do, if they'll...
Well, he's got to fight the other guy.
Personally, I would prefer if it just opened with him dead, honestly, just so they can kind of get that out of the way and not make it a thing. But, you know, we'll see, won't we?
I was
fine with it, I guess, if, you know...
Hopefully there aren't five of them. Six, if you count. A Balboa-esque movie.
So the other part that nearly got me was when Rocky's like, you know, so Apollo, not Apollo, god damn, Adonis fighting pretty Ricky Conlon, who I nearly called Pretty Boy Floyd, his eye is like swollen shut.
Oh yes.
And first of all, this is a great moment because the cut man, who has his hand on the back of his head to steady him while he's icing the eye, the ref comes over, puts his hand over his good eye so he effectively can't see and says, "How many fingers am I holding up?" And the cut man taps the back of his head like to tell him how many fingers are up. Oh my God, that was great.
And I don't know if you see, but the doctor, like on the second try, he looks around and he's just like, "What? How?"
And then, you know, Rocky says, "I should have thrown in the towel when your dad was like this. I'm not going to lose you too." And Adonis says, "No, I have to prove." And Rocky says, "You know, prove what? Like, what do you have to prove?" And he's like, "Prove I'm not a mistake." And I was like, "Oh my God, that's heartrending."
I just got to say though that, like, as much as I enjoyed the final sequence, I think all the wind was sucked out of the sails because of that first fight. That first fight, it just is so beautiful. It's just so well done. Even the narrative arc of the fight itself, and this film, I don't know.
Oh, I disagree. I thought the second fight was also amazing.
Yeah, they're two stylistically different fights, and I think the first one was good for a quick pop of action, and the second one was like a beautiful orchestration of, you know, a much longer fight. I mean, we're in spoilers. It goes to the end, and it ends like Rocky. It's a split decision. Adonis loses, but he wins because he's proven that he has what it takes. I thought it was perfect. The sound design in this movie is crazy.
Mm.
Every punch. Good lord.
Oh, yeah. And what did you guys think about the ending? The very ending?
Going up the steps?
Well...
I didn't need it, but...
Well, I mean, should we say that... I mean, he loses, but he...
That's what I just said that.
Did you just say that?
Yeah. Literally said
sorry.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he said split decision.
It ends exactly like Rocky. And it's I'm fine with that. It made sense.
Yeah.
And we all know that, you know, Nick loved the scene of him going up the whatchamacallit, the steps.
I think it's the public library. I think it is. I think it's the public library where
I think it is.
That is, yeah. Which, my God, people must really love reading in Philadelphia.
They have to go up all those steps.
Go up all those stairs. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I maybe just thought it was a little bit cheesy, but
I think it earned that by that point.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
And even moments from the trailer that seemed like they would be really cheesy, like when he points at the guy in the mirror and he says, "You know, that's your biggest opponent. I believe that's true in the ring, and I believe that's true in life." Like in the trailer, that's a terrible moment. And in the movie, it actually works really well.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Also, I love the meta concept of the Rocky statue in this movie.
Yeah. That was awesome.
It's so awesome.
Good lord. All right. Well, any final thoughts to say on this movie? It feels like we're all pretty universally positive on it. It made a bunch of money this weekend.
Yeah, as it should. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Definitely a good movie. All right. Well, then that means that we can move on to the other film that is on our docket. Everybody ready? By which I mean, Bill, are you ready?
Yep.
All right, great. So, the next film up is The Good Dinosaur, the newest film from Pixar, who just this summer had Inside Out. So, here is the trailer.
I think we went far enough today. Let's get you home.
So The Good Dinosaur is about Arlo, a cowardly Apatosaurus who is whisked away from his family by a deluge. Well, I guess it's just a normal river, actually. And he befriends a small human child. And this is in a world where that dinosaurs were not wiped out by an asteroid. Millions of years of evolution have occurred and turned them into an agrarian society. And humans have just basically entered the scene. So, I saw this, wrote the review for the film stage, gave it a B. Bill Graham, ugh, what do you think of The Good Dinosaur?
This was just completely inoffensive in the worst kind of way.
I am surprised that you say this is inoffensive.
This is, look, I am a huge Pixar fanboy, but I'm also very aware of their tendency to make films that people just absolutely groan at. And, you know, the Cars series is obviously one of those things.
What would one of the other ones be?
Their frequency of making sequels out of things that don't need sequels.
So we're still talking about Cars.
We're still talking about Cars. We're talking about Finding Nemo, aka Finding Dory now.
Yeah, but people flipped out over that trailer.
Oh my gosh. I just look at that and I'm like, really? Finding Dory?
The Dory.
Yeah. I'm just like, the only film that I think really needed a sequel is The Incredibles, and hopefully, finally, maybe we're gonna get that.
Were you not happy with the Toy Story sequels?
The first one is great. The second one was absolutely nearly a disaster. If you know, you read up on the history of it and things like that. They basically had seven months to basically scrap together a better film and turn it into what it is.
They succeeded.
Sure, they succeeded in it, but the reason they were going to make that movie had all the bad reasons around it. And now they're apparently maybe going to make a fourth one. I don't know. We'll see. But
the quality of the Toy Story movies
is quite good. Sure. I agree.
Okay.
But I think that is their worst habit, right? Is to make more sequels to a formula that has already succeeded. Instead of trying something new. And I understand the argument for that is to make money to have original ideas and go off and make a film like WALL-E or Up or things like that, or Inside Out,
which I cannot wait for the sequel to Inside Out. How on earth do you make a children's film about a person who's like, let's say, 16 or maybe going into college?
Ugh.
Can you imagine?
Ugh.
First, yeah. R-rated Pixar film.
Anyways, I don't understand how this film, on the heels of Inside Out, is what it is. And I think Brave was the first indication, obviously, that Pixar outside of the Cars series had little cracks in their foundation, where a film like that, that was also completely inoffensive. It was neither good nor bad. It had interesting concepts that they were messing with, and it just never really congealed into anything worthwhile, I didn't think. There's actually like fantastic pieces written about that film in particular that make you kind of re-examine what it is. But the fact is that upon initial watch, I was just completely flabbergasted that that was a Pixar film. And the same thing holds true with this. The Pixar way is to basically break down the narrative over and over and over and over and over, really, really kind of dig in deep to where, you know, you start looking at a normal film outside of the animated world and you wonder how there's ever a bad animated film, you know, when you have the ability to go through this process. And of course, Pixar is the one that kind of came up with that idea and really kind of ran it for all it's worth. But the fact that this film exists in a time period with a company like this that is just, it has like literally no personality. There's no pops of color.
What?
Yeah.
Wait.
You're talking about the Firefly scene? Like, besides that, which is obviously a very beautiful scene that reminds me way too much of Avatar, I thought this film just really doesn't have any kind of personality or character to it. And like I said, I'm not saying that it's a bad movie. I'm not saying it's a good movie, though. And for Pixar, that's one of the worst things that they can possibly do, is to make a film that you're like, okay, that was a movie. I wasn't impressed at any point in this film. Some people have called it a tech demo with a nice story slapped on top of it. And I think they're reaching for something, but even like the so basically the dinosaurs have existed on this, on, they never went extinct, right? Because the asteroid never hit.
Right.
And so they all have these kind of weird kind of, you know, human characteristics where they're, I guess, industrious, right? And everybody seems to be a farmer of some sort. Either, you know, the Tyrannosaurus Rexes that he runs into, who are cattle herders, yep, and his family, which are like literally grain farmers. They literally grain.
Well, it's not literally grain, it's corn.
Yeah, it's corn.
Corn is a grain, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought
corn's
so.
A grain.
Yeah.
I'm going to look this up.
You look that up. I'm going to
keep talking. I'm listening.
Corn, grain.
is she looking this up like out loud?
Field corn, I should know this. That I grew is up harvested on a farm. When the seeds are dry would thus be considered a grain.
A large grain plant.
Okay.
Yep. Anyways, so the film takes kind of painstaking care to show us the process of how they farm. And I just couldn't help but look at it and think of that comment about, you know, all the Pixar films kind of wrapped up in a nice neat bow, which is like, what if toys had feelings, and what if fish had feelings, and what if bugs had feelings, and all of this. And that really kind of makes me roll my eyes. But the sequence that they show to introduce you to the reality of these Potosauruses farming is just grown-worthy, I think.
Grain-worthy?
I was going to say grain-worthy, yeah. I
corn was the October grain of the month. According to the Whole
Grain Monthly
Council.
Yeah, I don't know. This film just really, really did not do it for me. Man. And I loved Inside Out. I loved Inside Out.
Well, yes. How could you not?
Blarf.
Yeah.
You didn't.
Yeah. She was on that podcast. I must have
blocked that out, because yeah. Holy shit.
I hate Inside Out. I just it was very meh to me.
She did not like the little girl.
Wow. We're going to go into this again.
I did not. You know, what,
I guess at a certain point in a relationship, you just start ignoring all the bad things, and
I know.
That's where we are.
It's funny that you bring up the whole, how would it, with
anthropomorphization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that is such a trope with Pixar films that
it is.
It was made fun of on a Simpsons episode, like, years and years ago. I mean, it's just such a thing that you would think.
That's such a thing that everyone does. That's what animation is for.
But they're very, I mean,
this one, like, usually they get away with it because they're creative and they're fun and they're like, right, they're like, oh yeah, this makes sense. Like, ha ha ha, how clever. And in this film, I just watched it and I was just like, oh no.
They get around it too in some movies, like in Up, where the dog has the collar that allows him to speak.
Well,
and
Up
things
is
like that.
One of the only movies that doesn't really have a whole lot of, you know,
yeah,
anthropomorphization going on. Yeah, that word is terrible. I don't know who came up with that word. It has
probably
a great meaning
or something.
But terrible word.
I'm gonna. Yeah, it's one of those things where it almost feels like they're definitely, I don't want to say running out of ideas.
No, Amanda, remind me, you didn't see this movie, correct?
No, I haven't seen this movie, but everything he's talking about, it's just like, wow, I don't want to see this movie. Yeah. And I'm glad I didn't see it.
I guess, again, there's no reason for me to give my opinion.
No, go ahead.
Because for some reason, Brian, I saw this film because we wanted to talk about it, and you didn't tell me, hey, don't bother.
No, because I fucking liked it.
Oh, no.
I just said go. I gave it a B on the film stage.
I know, and I groaned at that.
Here's the thing. There are some real issues with this film. First of all, it's called The Good Dinosaur, but that would speak to me that, like, the dinosaurs were antagonistically related to the humans, and this is, like, the first dinosaur to, like, really meet a human and befriend them. But that's not really how the movie plays it. So the name of the movie... I've hiccuped, I apologize. Doesn't make a lot of sense.
No. It doesn't.
I mean, so that, like, that, when you started that simple thing, it should be impossible to get over it. But no, I found the movie to be quite charming. I thought that many of the sequences were quite, not only harrowing, but some of them were very touching. And I thought that the movie went to some places that it did better than even things like Finding Nemo. Which is something that this is clearly patterned off of Finding Nemo in a way.
It's very, very patterned off of Finding Nemo. Yeah.
I was going to say, just listening to the trailer, I was like, is this Finding Nemo?
It's Finding Nemo if Nemo had agency. And instead of... What, Marlin's just, like, boring like in Finding Nemo.
Oh.
He's a bit of a coward, but also he's, like...
He's sheltered.
Yeah, he's weird. In this, you have Arlo, who basically starts off as a coward and then is, like, stricken with PTSD and has to overcome that. And I thought that was, like, this movie isn't afraid to go to some dark places and, like, honestly, probably scare kids. And I think that that's a valuable thing. I don't have a problem with that. I thought that the environmental effects are stunning. I mean, this movie looks so real that it made me forget at times that it was animated, that it was entirely animated.
Well, the dinosaurs look so cartoony, though.
I didn't have a problem with that. I thought that Arlo
was
really
cute. No, I'm not
saying
you should.
And I liked his animations. I liked his little, like, trying to stretch to get things. I liked his clumsiness walking up a mountain. And I liked Spot's animations. And I thought one of the reasons that I gave this such a high marks is the fact that we don't get a lot of time with a lot of the secondary characters. But I wanted more of that. And there's a richness to them that I appreciated, and I wanted to see more of them. And that's a mark of a good film, to create characters that I want to spend more time with.
With who specifically?
I wanted more of that.
Tell us about the animated dinosaurs you want to hang out with, Brian.
I don't know if he had a name. The crazy, like, Styracosaurus with all the comfort animals.
Forest Woodbush.
That makes sense. He was great. Like, this is stupid. I have, like, two friends who are applying for ESA, emotional support animals, and I find them to be perhaps the greatest human disappointments that I know. Because
hold on, the people,
yeah, what? My friends are great disappointments. Because if you have to, I'm gonna piss off someone, I don't care. If you have to sign up to be able to carry a kitten around with you to function in the world, like, that's an issue, and you need to see a therapist and not a kitten. And if the therapist told you to get the kitten, you need a new therapist.
That poor kitten.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? It's not even like it's a dog. Like, dogs need people. Dogs get sad without people. My roommate leaves, and her cat could give a shit. Like, the cat, you need an animal that's as emotionally crippled as you are so that you can have a codependent relationship or something. But I loved Forrest Woodbush in this movie because he has all these things and he's given them names. One of them is, what was it, Dream Killer? And he says it protects him from having unrealistic expectations.
Oh, man.
Like, that was great.
That's such a weird moment in this film.
Weirdly beautiful. Like, I loved that. And then, I guess, like, the whole flying dinosaurs were crazy. And something we could possibly get into in spoilers. Because the moment with them is something that I don't really want to spoil for people.
Okay. Just, save it.
It's just crazy. But also the T-Rexes. I like the T-Rexes a lot.
Yeah, I just noticed that Anna Paquin is Ramsay.
Yeah, she was one of the T-Rexes.
Yeah, that's... I did not recognize her her voice. I always... This is a little side thing, but I always love... I'm really bad at, like, picking out voices, and so... I always
Please
love,
tell me
like,
you
going...
didn't have trouble with Sam Elliott.
No, I already knew Sam Elliott as soon as I was like, "Where is his mustache? I don't see
it's
his mustache."
Weird. Yeah,
but yeah, I always love looking at the cast list after watching a film like this and just being like, "Oh, that's who that was." Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Like Jeffrey Wright was the dad. That was weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Frances McDormand is the mom.
Yep, I see.
I did pick out Steve Zahn immediately, though.
Sure. Yeah. Anyways, so I think the brothers or the brother and the sister and that whole kind of relationship
in Libby.
Yeah, that was interesting. I liked that part, but I don't know. We're going to have to figure out how to talk about the things that either you specifically liked and I did not, or
well, we could go into spoilers. I think
that seems like the best possible solution. Unless Amanda has anything else to say.
Oh, spoil it! Spoil it for me, please.
Do you have any questions, Amanda, about the film?
That... Since you're here,
I was trying to remember. I had read something the other day, and I actually just found it. Forbes did an article saying that this Pixar film is akin to Marvel's Ant-Man. What they're saying is that they're it's almost kind of like a cynical reading that because this film didn't get a whole lot of hype building up to its release, and because it is a more sort of like, obviously it's not a sequel, it's not like super, and it doesn't have a lot of like big names attached to it, that they're just trying to see if people will go see this movie based on the Pixar name alone.
I don't.
So
think
you're
so.
Saying like this is B-team Pixar, and they're trying to see if it'll make money anyways.
Right, basically, which
they
is like
done the same thing with Inside Out.
Well, Inside Out had some big names attached to it, though. That's the thing.
Sure.
Do cartoons ever get sold on the people voicing them?
Yes.
The adults, it does. Yeah.
No, hold on. Outside of the Pixar brand, absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Pixar's one of the few companies that really kind of made its name on not selling you on the voices themselves. And I get like Toy Story was what it was but I mean, Tim Allen was never a blockbuster kind of guy. I'm trying to remember the
he was pretty much purely Disney for a long time.
Yeah.
He did like the Shaggy Dog.
I mean,
things like that.
There are other films that plaster the names of the main characters, you know, like I'm thinking of like Shark Tale, where it was sold on the fact that, you know, Will Smith was the character and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There was another movie with Rihanna, and it's like they are selling the crap out of the fact that these big name people in popular culture, whether it's music, film, television, whatever, are voicing these characters.
But that's
versus
the thing. I mean, Pixar's never done that, so why would they have to prove that they could?
Like, that's why I think it's a little cynical.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
But this
sense.
Movie really didn't get that much hype. I mean, there wasn't any.
It didn't.
Really didn't. Like, there's no. I mean, leading up to Inside Out, I feel like there was a lot of hype around Inside Out.
I feel like there was about the same.
No,
because they released the trailer and everyone was like, "Oh my god, get ready to cry!" Blah blah blah. And then like that's.
I don't think Good Dinosaur got nearly as much promotion.
No, I don't think so either.
What kind of promotion are we talking about?
Just anything. I mean, it didn't.
I saw
Inside
posters.
Out had,
I saw things online. I don't watch TV. on a TV.
I didn't see anything on TV. I didn't see any. I didn't see any trailers before movies. Really. I mean, I don't know. But Inside Out. I heard about Inside Out like months and months before it came out.
Do you think that Inside Out was more? It was marketed to parents.
Right,
like,
and
no
I think
kid's gonna see Inside Out and be like, "Oh, I should go see Inside Out." But like The Good Dinosaur, maybe it was like playing on whatever the hell the Disney Channel is called now, or like Nickelodeon.
It's funny because you know I have friends with a 4-year-old who loves Inside Out, and that's not a film that is really gonna get inside of his head, right? But he's 4 and he loves that movie. So
I'm not saying they can't love it. I'm saying that you don't have to pitch it to kids.
Sure, sure.
Like, yeah, that's going to get pitched to the parents.
Amy Poehler and Mindy Kaling and Bill Hader, and you have all these like big
those
names.
Two people, the last two that you named, literally had like 6 lines in that movie.
But they have more of like an adult appeal, though, which I think like I don't know if there's I didn't know anybody like you just named a whole bunch of people in The Good Dinosaur. I had no idea any of those people were in this movie. I got to be honest, I didn't hear anything about this movie like leading up to it.
Well,
because you're not a child.
I think
you're not a child. I don't think that this was marketed to adults like Inside Out was marketed to adults.
But that what are the promotional are there like promotional things for children that adults don't have any
this
access
shit on
to?
Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel.
Hey, I watch Cartoon Network and I watch Disney Channel, so
well that know. Just brings up all kinds of questions.
Look, no, I watch cartoons.
But if we're talking strictly about...
I watch Rick
and
Morty. Does that count?
What's that? almost
that's
counts.
A cartoon.
That's definitely Adult Swim, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, but is there going to be Good Dinosaur toys at McDonald's or wherever?
I don't know. I have to agree with Amanda. I don't think this film was pushed quite as hard as Inside Out. But I think part of that is this film kind of sells itself. We've already seen that dinosaurs sell itself, right? In terms of Jurassic World.
Biggest movie ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All the money in the world when nobody thought it was going to make even $500 million worldwide.
Yeah, that's another way to look at it, is that Inside Out had a lot of hurdles to get over.
Sure, it was an original, high concept, really, really unique and weird to the point where it was way beyond WALL-E or even Monsters, Inc. in terms of just like the conception of what it was. That was a really tough film to sell to parents to bring their kids to, because as much as you might want to say you're selling a film to parents or adults, there are a certain sect there's a very large sect of adults that just simply will not show up to a film that either they're not drugged to by their kids or are seeing because they, you know, I mean, I got flack for going to watch this movie by myself. And it was like, yeah, because that is kind of weird, right? But it's like, I'm going to go see every single Pixar film in a theater. Like, sorry.
Yeah, you got to.
What was I gonna say?
You know what's surprising to me is how many adults love the fucking Minions.
Oh God, don't even. I don't. Goddamn, hate the Minions.
That. Like my old job, I worked with a bunch of ostensibly adult women who were just so psyched about the Minions, and I was
It's like adult women who wear overalls that have an iron-on patch of Eeyore,
or just
a sweatshirt that has Tweety Bird on it. I don't know. It's just. Ugh, don't.
You just described two of the most depressing things I can imagine.
It exists. My freshman year roommate. Yeah.
That's.
Oh yeah, terrifying. Love Dior. It's the same thing. It's just the same. It just drives me bananas.
Get
anyway.
Him on a t-shirt. Don't wear overalls with an iron-on patch.
Oh, there. It exists. I've seen it.
So do we want to do now that we've broken down the business angle? Do we want to do spoilers for The Good Dinosaur?
Sure, let's do it.
Spoil it. Spoil it.
We're going to spoil it. It's going to happen. So The Good Dinosaur, out in theaters now. I say give it a look. You can hear or read more of my thoughts on thefilmstage.com.
I say go the other direction. Run away.
And yeah, so here are spoilers for The Good Dinosaur. Well, I thought you had things that you wanted to talk about.
Were you
about.
Waiting for me?
No, I thought Bill had some shit he needed to spout at me.
Sure.
Well, your whole statement was, we need to talk about the things that I hated and you liked.
Yes. Okay.
So if you want to come at me, I'll
take it down. Okay, so
you're a false Creed.
baby Creed. Anyways, so I think the real heart of this film is obviously his reliance on family, right? His unshakable desire to get back to his family, even though, you know, his brother and sister weren't exactly all that nice to him, and he really didn't fit in to his kind of family dynamic either. They were all very strong, independent, you know, they served a purpose and a function, and he very notably continued to not serve his, you know, function that he was given. I think at one point they even comment on it that, you know, he's not good at having it. Yeah, he mentions, I think the T-Rexes ask him to go do a job. They're like, it's just a little job. And he's like, I'm not very good at jobs, you know.
Yeah.
And so he's constantly dealing with that. And I think the film does a pretty decent job of kind of setting that up, especially with Spot, the way they kind of set up the fact that he doesn't have family anymore. And that was it's a very touching moment when they kind of revealed their little literal stick figure, versions of themselves and their family dynamic and who's died and, you know, things like that. I think that's one of the few bright spots. Bright spots, spots that really kind of stand out in this film. But other than that, I really don't see a whole lot of redeeming things. Part of it is almost like kind of Amanda was hinting at. There's a lot of cliches of the Pixar kind of, you know, just the way that Pixar does things that kind of shine through in this film. You know, whether it's like, oh, here's the T-Rexes who are big and scary and strong and they're completely, you know, harmless and they're fun to be around and things like that. You know, even though the whole time you're like, oh, they're kind of scary looking. It reminds me of Finding Nemo again, you know, where the sharks come in and you're like, oh, this is going to be scary. And then they turned into just like these gentle kind of big guys.
But in Finding Nemo, there was still the inherent tension that the sharks might try to eat the fish.
Sure, yeah.
T-Rexes seem to have progressed beyond that.
Yeah, and I can't understand why. I'm really curious to see the dynamic of what they do with the longhorns that they're rustling. Do they end up eating them?
Yeah, they're going to eat the hell out of them.
So why did they not look at Arlo and be like, you look tasty. I haven't had anything green in quite a while.
You have a McDonald's next to you, correct? Or somewhere near you?
Sure.
Right, so are you going to murder your neighbor when you could just go get a hamburger?
No.
You're not going to murder and eat your neighbor?
No.
Why not?
Because that's
easier?
Because
it's easier.
Cannibalism.
Yeah, and at this point, I believe the dinosaurs have realized that they're all part of the same group, and they're not going to do it, which is what makes the crazy pterodactyl creatures even more terrifying.
I'll agree with you there. That's definitely a disturbing moment in the film when he eats that little
oh my God, yeah.
Raccoon creature thing.
I laughed and shouted at the screen, "What?"
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of parents that probably were like, "Oh, that was not a teachable moment. I don't know what to say about that."
I loved that scene. That was nuts. And their continued existence in the story was also nuts. And yeah, I liked it because, again, you know, a movie should make you feel real peril. And this movie did that.
For who?
For everyone. What are you talking about?
Like, you know Arlo's going to live. You know Spot's going to live.
I don't know, man. Like, when there's that second flood and, like, the pterodactyl creatures are real, like, there's still a sense of danger because you've seen that these friggin' creatures are just monsters. Just awful. Just
I don't know. I didn't see that in their feature.
Well, that's your issue, I guess.
I'm a cynical bastard.
Obviously, I don't think that Pixar is going to murder two cute, sweet little characters that are the leads of the film. But the fact that we're not in Finding Nemo, the main antagonist was a little girl who just shook a bag full of fish. Like, that's not even malice. That's just an accident. And in this movie, Arlo's main problem is fear, and fear of death, particularly. And he has to go up against a monstrous enemy that actually could kill him and wants to kill him and Spot. I mean, that's some dark, heavy shit. And they pull it off.
Can I ask a question? Does a character die in this question. Movie?
Wait, what was that?
Does a character die in this movie?
The father.
The father is the only one.
And a small creature.
So, and a beetle. It's funny because when I was looking this up, apparently a lot of parents are mad that their children were traumatized during this movie because a character died. Which, all I gotta say is, get the fuck over it.
It was either the raccoon thing or it was probably Papa. But, yeah. I mean, Papa... Lion King's done that so much better. So
exactly, it's like Bambi. Have we could seen go for Bambi. Yeah. Bambi.
I Dumbo's will say for some reason. For some reason, this one seemed a little more brutal than any of those other ones, though.
Oh no!
Like Lion King, no. Like I don't know, because Lion King, you see him falling towards the wildebeest, but you don't see him like crushed and trampled underfoot. You see him falling, and then right when he's about to enter the herd. It does the zoom into Simba's face. Bambi's mom is shot off screen. I honestly don't remember what it was like when Nemo's mom died.
You don't see it.
All those things. The thing about Lion King is Lion King builds up his father to quite a point where when he dies, it's 20-25 minutes into the film, and you're like, oh.
Well,
okay.
I'm not talking about emotionally. I'm talking about like viscerally. Like the death of the father in this film is pretty goddamn abrupt and harsh. I mean, you see this wall of water choked with trees coming towards him, and he looks up at Arlo. I mean, this is a father and son who are making full-on eye contact, and that's when he dies. I mean, that's... And the noise, the sound design of that scene, it was harsh, man. I was like, damn, I can't believe they did that.
I think I'm just one of those, I was one of those unfortunate children whose mother made the mistake of renting Watership Down, thinking it was a kid's movie.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know.
That's definitely not.
When I was three, I watched Top Gun, and so I got to see Goose die. So, you know, you can't hurt me more than that.
Oh, have you seen oh, God. Yeah. Good God. You want to see a horrible nightmare of a film?
Yeah, totally.
Go ahead and watch Watership Down when you're like a six-year-old child.
Well, I will work on becoming a six-year-old child again.
Do it, man. You can do it. I believe in you.
Well, I gotta get going, so...
Yeah,
I was gonna wrap up.
Like, this is minor Pixar, yes, but I don't think it's a failure. I don't think it's unforgettable. I think it's definitely worthwhile, and people should check it out.
We'll agree to disagree, but we still love Inside Out, and so we got a bone to pick with you, Amanda.
Yeah, so Amanda's really the only odd man out on this.
It was meh. It was meh.
You know what? Your life is meh. that's all I've got to say about that.
Okay.
All right. Well, I guess that's it. We should wrap up and, you know, just get the hell out of here. So, this has been it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. Now, let us tell everyone at home where we can be found. So, Bill Graham, where can we find you online in the meantime?
You can find me at the film stage and and on Twitter at CableBFG.
All right. Amanda Waltz, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at MediaWaltz. You can also find me, Edie Waltz, on Letterboxd, and my blog, Steel Cinema, on WordPress.
And you can, of course, find me on Twitter, at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on the Film Stage, where I write reviews. And that is, that's pretty much it. I haven't written on dearfilm.net in a while. So that's all. Join us next week when we'll be talking about something, though I don't 100% know exactly what it is yet. Amanda, do you know what we're talking about next week?
No.
All right. Well,
that music
sucks
is really loud.
What?
That music is really loud.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Tune in next week.